the judge can drop dead in his black robes. We will not call off the strike.
We're going to burn. We're going to shoot. We're going to fight. We're going to kick. We're going to bite. You know what I'm saying? We're going to be like a woman if that's what we want to be.
It's going to be burned.
Hey,
it's burned.
Hey, this whole city is going to be burned.
Throughout these 37 days, there has been continued violence against the people of South Vietnam.
We're getting a lot of casualties. I need help. I got two elements cut off.
I love my president, but I love my country more.
It would not be judgment speaking so much as it would be some irritation and exasperation.
Here is the story of 1966, told in voices and sounds, gathered on the scene by correspondents of the United Press International Audio Network. I'm Duff Thomas. Vietnam was unknown to most Americans only a few years ago. In 1966, Vietnam was the year's biggest story. There were other newsworthy places and events, civil rights, Congress, business, and labor, but Vietnam, a war, young men dying, and a questioning world opinion dominated the news. As the year began, the United States was in the midst of a pause in its bombing of North Vietnam, hoping to perceive some sign from the communists that they wished to de-escalate or even end the war. But as Secretary of State Dean Rusk said,
I found no one who had any indication or belief that the authorities in Hanoi had decided to give up their aggressive ambitions or to come to a conference table to bring about a peaceful settlement. It seems to me, therefore, that our present course is clear: to support our own men in uniform and their allies, and to proceed as rapidly as possible with the political, economic, and social measures in Vietnam which are required, even in the midst of war.
And America's course was clear. As the air war over the North intensified, American pilots ran into increasing trouble. More planes were downed by anti-aircraft fire and ground-to-air missiles. On the ground, Marines and air cavalrymen pushed through thick jungles and wet rice paddies and deep rivers to keep the communists off guard and on the defensive. An expected full-scale offensive by the communists was stopped. Correspondent Bill Riley with the patrol gave a vivid account of the GI's life in Vietnam.
GIs holding the rifles above their heads. Thunder rolling above us. One just fell.
American troop strength in Vietnam advanced to over 360,000 men, with more promised in 1967. More than 5,500 Americans were killed. President Johnson went to the scene of battle, and on the sands of Cam Ranh Bay, he told the GIs,
make no mistake about it, the American people that you represent are proud of you.
Not everyone supported U.S. presence in Vietnam. Congress had its objectors, and they tightened when the president asked for more money to pursue the war. Arkansas Democrat J. William Fulbright coined the phrase credibility gap, saying he couldn't get a straight answer from the administration about the war. Republicans picked it up. House Minority Leader Gerald Ford restated congressional disapproval.
There are those in this administration who appear to believe that half a truth is better than none. We disagree. Where the American people at home are concerned, we must have the whole truth.
But the money came. There seemed little else to do. Others did not like the United States in Vietnam. Some citizens of South Vietnam, Buddhists primarily, went for the throat of Nguyen Cao Ky's government and hindered South Vietnamese efforts on the battlefield.
We don't like the war in Vietnam.
Yes?
Yes, now I will ask the American go home and bring the war, come back to the America.
Free elections were promised and held, despite the worst Viet Cong terrorists could hand out. A constituent assembly was chosen to pave the way for further free elections. With 70% of the South Vietnamese population voting, government officials called it a sharp defeat for the communists who tried to upset the elections. As the sounds of war continued without let-up, the talk was about peace. Everyone said they wanted it, including the communists. Every side had terms, none of them agreeable, and the war went on. When the year began, the United States was in the midst of a 37-day pause in its bombing of North Vietnam. Diplomats throughout the world told U.S. officials that the pause might lead to peace talks. U.S. Ambassadors Harriman and Goldberg carried the quest for peace all over the world. President Johnson was forced to call off the pause because...
Throughout these 37 days, even at moments of truce, there has been continued violence against the people of South Vietnam, against their government, against their soldiers, and against our own American forces.
Pope Paul VI, Britain's Prime Minister Harold Wilson, and Canada's Prime Minister Lester Pearson all tried for peace in 1966. UN Secretary General U Thant announced that he would not take a new five-year term when his personal peace offensives ran into opposition in the Security Council.
I think I should decide one way or the other, perhaps before June, so that the Security Council will be in a position to nominate someone to succeed me if I decide not to offer myself for the second term, to recommend to the General Assembly. Of course, if the Security Council were in a position to find someone to be recommended to the General Assembly to succeed me in the course of the next few months, I believe it will facilitate my decision.
He was prevailed upon to stay, however, and he announced he would continue his efforts to achieve peace in Vietnam. However, all efforts produced the same negative response from Hanoi and Peking. Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen best expressed everyone's feelings when he sounded a note of disappointment.
That this country, with all its resources and assets, with its wealth and its manpower, hasn't been able to bring this to an honorable conclusion more quickly than they have.
In this country, many expressed their dislike for war. The most aggressive were the students who picketed, burned draft cards, and adopted many of the tactics and sloganizing ways of another American revolt, civil rights. New York Senator Robert Kennedy, with whom young Americans increasingly identify, expressed his concern.
I might disagree with some of the demonstrations that are taking place, and in fact I do. And I think that the fact that so many young people and so many of the rest of our citizens are taking such an active interest in this matter, I think it's healthy for the country.
Most of the men fighting in Vietnam didn't request it, and a rumble arose over the draft system. Students opposed schools providing class rankings to draft boards as a method of handing out deferments. Civil rights leaders turned their attention to this problem as well as the new lowered induction standards. Harlem Congressman Adam Clayton Powell expressed his objection.
Seems to me America should be comforted in the knowledge that a higher percentage of black students is already dying in what is ingloriously being referred to in black communities as a white man's war against brown people.
Some already in uniform objected to the war. Several refused to go to Vietnam. The most outspoken critic of the war was again Senator Wayne Morse. The Oregon Democrat's raspy voice echoed through the empty Senate chamber.
I love my president, but I love my country more. And I want to say that if we follow the president's war-making course of action, the American people will end up involved in a massive war against both China and Russia, and out of that will come no victors.
Senator Morse and others said Vietnam would KO the president and his party in the November congressional and gubernatorial elections. The GOP did gain 47 House seats, 3 in the Senate, and 8 governorships, but political analysts said this was not conclusive because many Republican winners supported the administration Vietnam policy. President Johnson didn't interpret it that way either.
As a good American, I think we're all glad to see a healthy and competent existence of a two-party system.
The elections produced some Republican presidential timber. California Governor Ronald Reagan, Illinois Senator Charles Percy, and Michigan Governor George Romney. Reagan and Percy's elections, some said, were due to a white backlash. Reagan said it wasn't so, and he pointed across the country to the election of Massachusetts Negro Edward Brooke as senator.
I find it very difficult to assess a Republican victory on the basis of white backlash when it's the Republican Party that elected the first Negro to the United States Senate in almost 100 years.
Brooke viewed his victory this way.
The people of this great state have answered all of the George Rockwells, have answered all of the people who would divide us and who would keep men from being brothers. And I intend to say to the people of this state that I will do everything within my power to merit their confidence and their support and their faith in me as a man.
The other major issue in the 1966 campaign was inflation. Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen laid out the GOP position this way.
You can't have both guns and butter. Can't fight a war in Asia and win the war on the inflation at home unless, and I emphasize it, unless this government of ours, this administration, is equally willing to do without and to stop its willful, reckless spending of the people's money on non-essential things.
The cost of new cars rose, as did the prices of steel and food. Gardner Ackley, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, made this observation.
In my view, the action of these companies can only be characterized as irresponsible. They were unwilling even to hear the government state the public interest in this matter.
Housewives decided something had to be done.
Due to many requests from all over the country, we have decided to try to organize the housewives nationally. Now, we've had requests from Florida and from Nova Scotia, from Canada, from New York, on how to organize, on what to do about this. We have had much, much interest.
They began the petticoat war on high food prices.
We have felt that it is a very good time for the housewife to work for lower prices in many areas. As a unified group band together, we'll have power, and we'll be able to put the pressure on in Washington or in any facet of the economy that we wish to put the pressure on.
Boycotts and picketing became weapons of the housewives' army as the war gained momentum throughout the nation. In some cities, battles were won and prices were reduced. But overall, the merchants proved that costs to them justified the current prices. Clarence Adamy, president of the National Association of Food Chains, thought the women were wrong in protesting against supermarkets.
I do feel that they'll find that they'll be more effective in their protest if they would attack the causes of inflation and not the results or the symptoms of inflation.
The Johnson administration had problems curbing inflationary trends when it came to settling major labor disputes. The president's 3.2% wage price guidelines became a thing of the past. As one settlement after another disregarded the suggestion, government officials became more and more concerned over the inflationary trend. There were costly strikes in the transportation and communication industries, which attracted nationwide attention. The year began with a subway and bus strike in New York City, which practically crippled the great metropolis for 12 days. In the midst of the strike, Michael Quill, longtime leader of the Transport Workers Union and one of the most colorful labor leaders, was jailed for violating a court injunction to call off the strike. The tough Irish-American said,
"The judge can drop dead in his black robes. We will not call off the strike."
Quill was taken to jail, where he suffered a heart attack. After the strike was settled, Quill made a rapid recovery and was released from custody and the hospital. A second heart attack days later claimed his life. A strike in the airlines industry crippled domestic and foreign travel for 42 days. Some bitter humor popped up. When the walkout occurred, Labor Secretary Willard Wirtz was in Japan, unable to get a plane flight back to Washington to aid in settling the dispute. Again in New York City, the longest newspaper strike in history resulted in the folding of the Herald Tribune and the formation of a new newspaper, the World Journal Tribune. Former Trib owner John Hay Whitney.
The Herald Tribune in New York will not appear again. I know we gave something good to our city while we published, and I know it will be a loss to journalism in this country as we cease publication.
1966 did not provide a focal point for the civil rights movement. The closest occasion for pulling together interest came when James Meredith, the first Negro to attend the University of Mississippi, was shot while on a march through that state. Before marching, Meredith explained the conditions which he felt existed there and the purpose of his walk.
The Negro from Mississippi has a lot that he can do for himself. But the thing that's holding him back in Mississippi is this fear. Fear of unequal treatment before the law. And this is a greater fear than the fear of, we'll say, physical violence by individual whites.
Meredith was shot from ambush along the route of his march, but his injuries were not serious. Other civil rights leaders descended on Mississippi and organized a mass march to continue along the Meredith Pass. At the end of the march, a huge rally was held in Jackson to provide a final impact. It was at this event that the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael, came forward with a new explosive phrase.
There are three turns that black people in this country should learn at birth. One is white supremacy, one is neo-colonialism, and one is black power.
No sooner had Carmichael said it than a half dozen Negroes claimed they first coined the phrase. Instead of unifying the rights movement, the cry for black power became the wedge which almost split it. Everyone employed his own definition for black power, but the slogan became associated with the more militant groups, such as SNCC and CORE. The more conservative rights leaders, such as Dr. Martin Luther King and Roy Wilkins, viewed black power as harmful to the rights movement. Wilkins explained.
Ideologically, it dictates up with black and down with white. In precisely the same fashion that South Africa reverses the slogan. It is, in fact, a reverse Mississippi, a reverse Hitler, a reverse Ku Klux Klan.
Regardless of what proponents of black power said it could do, civil rights legislation did not fare well in 1966. The civil rights movement suffered its first major setback since 1957. Congress turned back the 1966 Civil Rights Bill. However, the 1965 Voting Rights Act was upheld by the Supreme Court, which ruled that the federal government could send examiners into state jurisdictions to register voters. White backlash seemed to be the reason for the election of some candidates. Perhaps it was because in November, many people remembered the cry of black power and what they associated with it. This was Cleveland, Ohio, but similar sounds were heard in Dayton, Atlanta, San Francisco, Oakland, Omaha, Muskegon, New York, Waukegan, Benton Harbor, and St. Louis. It was senseless, it did no good, and in nearly every case, local officials blamed it on outsiders. For example, Waukegan Mayor Robert Sabonjian said,
I will not tolerate outside organizations or individuals to come into our community to usurp our home rule.
One news story in 1966 touched several bases at once. Negro Julian Bond, former officer in SNCC, was elected to the Georgia legislature in 1965. The legislature denied him his seat, apparently because of some remarks he made about Vietnam.
I'm fighting a battle over my right to say what I choose and the right of the people who live in my district and my constituency to make a free choice of who they want to represent them. That's the issue. It's not Vietnam.
Another election was held, and he won again. Once more, he was denied a seat. He took it to the Supreme Court, and the court ruled that his freedom of speech had been abridged. Bond won for a third time, and apparently Georgia House leaders will not oppose his right to the job in 1967. As Vietnam divided the country, it also brought some changes in relations with other countries. Some of America's friends, notably South Korea, New Zealand, the Philippines, and Australia, sent troops to help fight in Vietnam. In the colder waters of the Atlantic, it was a different story. England supported the U.S. position morally and diplomatically, but sent no troops. France, America's oldest ally, opposed U.S. involvement in the war and backed many diplomatic moves aimed at discrediting American objectives in that country. When he returned from a visit to Europe, Richard Nixon had this observation about America's friends.
As I traveled through the capitals of Europe, what was shocking to me was that in talking to old friends in London and Paris and Rome, friends of freedom too, who I thought understood this great conflict between communism and freedom. There was not just neutrality with regard to our position in Vietnam, but opposition to it. although publicly, of course, they are remaining, shall we say, politely silent.
French President Charles de Gaulle continued moving his country farther away from the United States into a neutral position in the Cold War by wooing the Soviet Union and other communist nations. De Gaulle made an 11-day trip to Russia, which ended with a joint call for an end to foreign intervention in Vietnam. Soviet Premier Alexei Kosygin reciprocated later in the year with a 9-day visit to France. De Gaulle gave him a royal welcome.
Car on connaît bien et on estime beaucoup ici.
De Gaulle also pulled the rug out from under the entire European Allied Mutual Defense System by declaring French withdrawal from all military aspects of NATO and demanding that all foreign bases be removed from French soil. The French ambassador in Washington, Charles Lucet, said that this did not mean France was backing out of her commitments.
We want to remain your friend and your ally within the Atlantic Alliance. We know that this alliance is still indispensable for the balance and for the peace of the world. We do not think that the military threat is so great in Europe today. But if this threat were to be revived, you know which side we would be on.
The other 14 NATO members decided that the organization could function regardless of French policy and reaffirmed that the pact would continue. Plans were made to move the military command to Belgium as France withdrew her troops from NATO command. President Johnson sought during 1966 to maintain and improve relations with many nations. He traveled to Mexico and expressed continued American interest in the Alliance for Progress. The chief executive made the most extensive trip ever by an American president. He journeyed more than 32,000 miles, stopping in New Zealand, Australia, the Philippines, South Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, and South Korea. He was warmly received at every stop. He told the people in each of these countries that American objectives in that part of the world are to build freedom, peace, and prosperity for all, and to eradicate ignorance, poverty, and disease.
There is new hope, a new vision in this vast area of the world. Nations are joining together not only to resist aggression and to prove that might does not make life, but to make a decent life possible for all of their people.
Despite the war in Vietnam, Russia expressed a desire for better understanding with the United States in areas of mutual interest. An air pact was signed providing for direct airline service between New York and Moscow. A treaty to ban nuclear weapons in outer space was signed by the U.S., Russia, and other U.N. members. Diplomats also revealed that a nuclear non-proliferation treaty was nearer to reality than ever before. And President Johnson announced that Americans would find it easier in the future to travel in communist countries. Areas of mutual interest also meant an exchange of weather data gathered by the satellites of both nations. In 1966, the Russians became the first nation to land a spacecraft intact on the surface of the moon. The Soviets also accomplished a crash landing onto Venus. But the biggest space records were scored by the United States.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have ignition.
There's ignition. Billowing, pouring, colored clouds, boiling up from the... And there's liftoff.
Lunar orbiters 1 and 2 returned spectacular pictures of the moon's surface. Surveyor 1 functioned beautifully, managed a soft landing on the moon, and also returned sharp, detailed photographs of the lunar surface. The manned Gemini program was concluded after accomplishing almost everything it set out to do. There were 5 two-man space shots during the year, beginning with Gemini 8 in March. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and David Scott performed the first rendezvous and docking with another vehicle in space. Of all the missions in 1966, Gemini 9 had the most problems getting off the ground. The first attempt to orbit a target vehicle failed. A second attempt to get the mission going failed when computer trouble necessitated postponing the flight for 2 days. On the third try, all launch operations went without a hitch, and astronauts Tom Stafford and Eugene Cernan were off on their 3-day mission. They set an accuracy record on splashdown, landing just 300 yards off target after 44 orbits. Not all went so well in space, as rendezvous was achieved, but docking became impossible, as the astronauts told Mission Control.
People at the Cape in Houston, do not believe we can get the shroud separated. All
Astronauts John Young and Michael Collins in Gemini 10 hit a high altitude mark of 475 miles. That record was broken on Gemini 11 by astronauts Pete Conrad and Richard Gordon, who guided their spacecraft to an altitude of 850 miles. Gordon ran into problems during his spacewalk. Command pilot Pete Conrad called Gordon back into the spacecraft early. In the final mission of the program, Gemini 12 spacewalker Buzz Aldrin proved that spacewalking and working could be done. With Gemini completed, the next steps for American scientists became Apollo and the Moon. Director of the Manned Space Flight Center in Houston, Robert Gilruth, took aim at a lunar landing.
With our time schedule and with the present state of Apollo, it's in the best interest of getting on with the program to close out Gemini now and put our full effort into the Apollo program.
Natural disasters claimed many lives in 1966. Earthquakes in Varto, Turkey and Tashkent, Russia claimed hundreds of lives. Floods in Italy took many lives and ruined works of art, which can never be replaced, and resulted in millions of dollars worth of property damage. When it was over, correspondent Ernie Letito described the scene.
Over a piece of dried meat. The loser cursed the winner. I saw others, many of them, digging through heaps of mud and garbage, looking for something to eat. Hundreds of trucks poured into the city with food and water, but there was not enough to go around.
In Abfafan, South Wales, a black avalanche of coal slag came down on a schoolhouse, killing 137 children and seven adults. Gwyneth Davies saw the disaster from her home and gave this description.
We heard this terrible roar like a death, and everything started to shake, so we ran out the back, and all we could see was a terrible cloud of black dust, and then absolute stillness. I've never known such a horrible stillness in all my life.
The Supreme Court in 1966 handed down a decision outlining strict guidelines to be followed by police to protect suspects from self-incrimination. The High Tribunal ruled that all suspects must be advised of their rights before being questioned. Other significant events included the first operation for implanting an artificial heart.
This is Richard Iser, United Press International in Houston. Dr. Michael E. DeBakey, famed heart surgeon of the Methodist Hospital here in Houston, confirmed this afternoon at 4 o'clock Houston time that a left ventricle bypass operation was performed by him at this hospital this morning. The pump is operating satisfactorily, and the patient's immediate post-operative condition is good.
President Johnson entered the hospital for two operations. He had a small polyp removed from his throat and had a repair job done on the scar from his gallbladder operation of the year before. On July 1st, Medicare went into effect, and immediate acceptance and success of the plan was credited by federal officials. In New York City, King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, on an official state visit to America, was snubbed by city officials after he told newsmen that all Jews who support Israel are his enemies.
The king will dine alone tonight. Late this morning, Mayor Lindsay's office, in a terse statement, had this to say.
The dinner is canceled. Under the circumstances, the mayor has concluded that it would not be feasible to proceed with a dinner.
The mayor was described as deeply disturbed over the anti-Jewish remarks of King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. This is Art McAloon in New York.
England's recording stars The Beatles found discord when mop-top John Lennon offended fans by claiming the rock and roll group was as popular as Jesus. Lennon said he was misunderstood.
I wasn't saying whatever they were saying I was saying anyway. That's the main thing about it. I wasn't saying the Beatles are better than Jesus or God or Christianity. I was using the name Beatles because I can use them easier. And I was using, you know, because I can talk about Beatles as a separate thing, but I could have said TV or cinema or anything else that's popular.
Lennon apologized for making the remark, and Birmingham, Alabama disc jockey Tommy Charles, who began a campaign to burn all Beatle records, accepted it.
We accept his apology and in the manner in which it was offered. We think it's the least we can do. An offhand remark like this is not only dangerous, but it's it can be very impressionable on the young folks, and we think that they have made a wise decision, and we accept their apology.
The gala social event of the year took place in August when the president's daughter, Lucy Baines Johnson, married Patrick J. Nugent of Waukegan, Illinois. Not all the world's leaders had such happy occasions to spell them from the pressures of world affairs. In England, Prime Minister Harold Wilson's Labour government won a smashing victory for another term in power, but the mandate did not prevent strong opposition to new economic policies. In an effort to stabilize the economy, Wilson ordered a wage price freeze. By year's end, Britain's economy had not advanced, and Wilson was forced to extend the wage price freeze for another 6 months. A 45-day shipping strike added to his troubles. England also had a Commonwealth crisis with the breakaway colony of Rhodesia. The Ian Smith regime celebrated its first anniversary since declaring unilateral independence, and the British made no progress toward bringing the white supremacists to heel. When a last-ditch attempt to settle the matter failed, Foreign Secretary George Brown went to the United Nations and requested
sanctions which will cause the greatest economic damage to the illegal regime.
The other white-only government in Africa made news in 1966. Prime Minister Hendrik Fufort swept back into office in South Africa with a strong mandate to continue his race separatist policies. A white man working in the legislature assassinated the architect of apartheid as he sat in the parliament. Acting Prime Minister Donje announced the tragedy to the world.
It is my sad duty to express on behalf of all the tremendous sense of loss which overwhelms us all on this tragic day. A cedar of the Lebanon has fallen.
The death of another head of state occurred at the beginning of the year. India's Prime Minister Shastri died of a heart attack soon after signing a treaty in Tashkent, Russia, with President Mohammad Ayub Khan of Pakistan. The Tashkent Treaty ended war between the two nations on the Indian subcontinent. The world's only woman head of state, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, was sworn in as Prime Minister. While holding India to a neutral position on the Vietnam War, Mrs. Gandhi tried in vain to get peace talks going.
We in India are greatly interested and concerned about peace. For to us, it is not only a question of an ideal, but one of very practical necessity.
In Spain, Generalissimo Franco presented a new constitution for approval. The new document would provide for continuance of the monarchy and allow Franco to choose the new king. The reins of government changed hands in Germany with the formation of a grand coalition between the Christian and Social Democrats. Kurt George Kiesinger took over for Ludwig Erhard as chancellor. Kiesinger had been a member of Hitler's Nazi party, and while German officials discounted any neo-Nazi activity in the country, world leaders watched with concern as the National Democratic Party made substantial gains in two local elections. Spheres of influence changed in 1966, and the biggest setbacks were suffered by communism. President Sukarno of Indonesia handed over control of his government to Lieutenant General Suharto after the military put down an attempted communist-inspired coup d'etat. The Communist Party was outlawed by the new military leader, and Indonesia witnessed mass killings in a blood-red purge of leftist elements. Ghana's army threw out President Kwame Nkrumah and his government, saying the myth surrounding Nkrumah had been broken. The new Ghanaian government proceeded to expel all Russian advisors who had been working in the country and also asked Chinese communists to leave. A similar pattern occurred in Nigeria, where the army assumed control of the country and all communists were asked to return home. There were a few old areas of conflict which could have exploded into new war zones. Border clashes between Israel and her Arab neighbors kept tensions high in the Middle East. Israel was censured by the United Nations for a raid made into Jordan. Israeli Ambassador Michael Comey expressed regret over the UN action.
It is a matter of profound regret that the Security Council has acted upon complaints concerning Israel reactions, but has not been able for 15 years to adopt any resolution on Israel's complaints.
In 1966, the split widened between communism's two giants, Russia and mainland China. Both countries publicly expressed their discontent by walking out of official ceremonies in protest over each other's policies and statements. The split divided the entire communist world, making it necessary for the West to readjust its thinking and military defense plans. Red China alone passed through a period of turmoil not seen since its founding. a purge of high-ranking communist officials, such as Peking Mayor Peng Chen, the promotion of others, such as Lin Biao, to the number two spot in the hierarchy of power, behind Chairman Mao Zedong, and the formation of the Red Guard, all evidence the great internal struggle waged behind the bamboo curtain. The Red Guard, sort of an organized, state-thinking mass of young people, surged through the streets of China's major cities, bent on destroying all signs of Western influence. They clutched their Mao books and screamed insults at traditional Chinese. Correspondent Ralph Yardley picked up this information in the Bamboo Curtain listening post of Hong Kong.
The Red Guards made their first appearance on August 18th at a huge mass rally in Peking. Since then, the undisciplined gangs of teenagers have been on a revolutionary rampage aimed at wiping out all signs of what the communists call bourgeois culture. There are reports of bloodshed in some cities. Now, the Communist Party leaders have ordered the Red Guards to slow down. They directed the youthful bands to establish more responsible leadership and to discipline themselves like soldiers. The signs are that the Red Guards are complying with the party's orders.
China also exploded two nuclear bombs during the year. One device was carried on the head of a missile, indicating that China was progressing more rapidly than earlier expected in its development of long-range missiles and nuclear capability. China's support of North Vietnam and its belligerent attitude on peace talks to settle the war were the principal reasons that conflict raged throughout the year. The president could not make the war popular in Congress, but he was given all he asked for and more in the way of military appropriations to fight it. As many congressmen explained, there was no other course. On domestic issues, the 89th Congress was very productive. President Johnson swelled with pride over its accomplishments.
And the historians of tomorrow, right up today, they will say of the 89th, in my judgment, this was the great Congress.
The first session of the 89th accomplished most of the work. The second, however, became one of discontent. In 1965, Congress stamped its approval on one controversial piece of legislation after another. In 1966, congressmen became annoyed with the president's demands and refused to be coerced into decisions which could return to haunt its members up for re-election at the end of the year. President Johnson was defeated on two major bills, the 1966 Civil Rights Bill and repeal of Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act, the so-called state right-to-work laws. Most observers agreed with President Johnson that the 89th Congress will go down in history as a great Congress. Despite the pressure of the Vietnam War, much was done without putting the country into a wartime economy, and concern for the war will play a dominating role when the 90th Congress meets in 1967 to draft new legislation. One unrelated item Congress may have to consider concerns an incident with America's space activities. A Watsonville, California man, John Karchus, scratched his grandson's name on the Surveyor 1 spacecraft and then announced to the world after its moon landing,
I, John Karchus, do hereby lay claim to that part of the Earth's satellite, the moon, which is within the radius of 10 miles in all directions from the spot where Surveyor 1 landed on the Ocean of Storms, Oceanus Procellanum.
Mr. Karchus added that he plans to charge Americans $1 and all foreign nationals $1 million per person to visit his portion of the moon. That is, if no laws are passed prohibiting private citizens from claiming land on celestial bodies. And that's 1966 in review.